Welcome to another episode of Athens and Jerusalem. Let's begin where we can't escape. Let's begin with Logos.
Now, I would say that this openness, this being in the world, this referring to the world, to objects in the world, what I would like to call self-transcendence, this is disappearing as soon as you project a human being into a lower dimension than its own dimension.
The point of the V goes up to the nuclear explosion that created it.
Tell me this, Dr. Oppenheimer. Do you ever become frightened at what you're finding out here in this area that can't be measured in either time or space?
You see, that's a real point.
Do not be afraid. Open your hearts, open up your hearts.
Open up your hearts to Athens and Jerusalem. The infants of our culture, united, independent, polarized, and even bloody. Athens, the cradle of wisdom and rationality. Jerusalem, the cradle of faith and spirituality. In this podcast, we look at reunion. Could reason be more than modern secular skepticism? And could spirituality be more than belief? So welcome to another episode of the Athens and Jerusalem podcast. We are the three of us today, and in our last podcast, we discussed this idea about abolishing school. And in the end of the session, we started to discuss if this may be a more like an Western civilization problem with school today, and also that I have this feeling that this notion that our approach to the whole problem of Athens and Jerusalem might be a very academic way of thinking, and we are very intellectual approach to our way of seeing this problem. So I just wondering if should we try to have a more practical approach towards Athens and Jerusalem problem, and what is really happening in reality and in practice in our faith and in our way of being in science. And I know that you, Cameron, you have some thoughts on this, and also this idea about the global citizenship.
Yes, well, you know, you have raised lots of very important questions that I think need to be addressed, and the two of you are certainly better equipped to address some of the important philosophical aspects of this. But yes, talking about practicalities, I think one very practical thing that we could start with is the fact that current statistics show that at least all over the Western world, young people are feeling, if one could say so, like this, are feeling worse than ever before. The issues of mental health. And I don't mean, you know, like people having necessarily very serious mental, but things like a sense of not having a real hold on life, as it were. These are issues that are now troubling young people all over the Western world. And this is why these issues are now being addressed, actually, in many different countries. In different ways, trying to address the issue of well-being in schools. And I think the reason for this is that schools have become, and of course this is not my analysis, this has been done by many greater thinkers, have become sort of like knowledge factories. In fact, that the school system that we have today in many ways is a product of the industrial paradigm, so to say. And so we're trying to push young people through this sort of assembly line where we add different bits of knowledge from different disciplines into their heads, and hoping that they come out with good results in the PISA tables. And in this whole process, an important aspects of their humanity and their identity are being neglected. And young people are obviously sort of reacting to that. Now, so I think this is one of the issues that we need to discuss and say, well, what is it that is really lacking there? And why have we ended up in this situation? And what needs to be sort of added? How do schools need to become transformed in order for them to become engines of transformation for society? And in fact, this is in itself I'm sure we have addressed this earlier on too, that if you look at the sort of the, as it were, the historical genes of the school system, educational, especially public education and educational system, was initially established in order to consolidate an existing system rather than to transform something. And this seems to be still very much the way that the educational system functions. The message is, you know, like, come to our school, come to our university, and you'll become successful in the existing world. So we'll make you into a good cog in the existing machine. And I think the issue here is that the existing world and the existing machine is a very poorly functioning one. And so we need to transform it rather than to adapt to it. And so I think that's I think one of the issues that that needs to be addressed.
So if this is more or less like a Western youth problem, couldn't we try to look at other school system or other ways of growing up and see if could that be a more healthy way of becoming a mature person?
Unfortunately, the Western paradigm, both in science and education, has become the standard even globally. And in fact, I think one may find that in many non-Western countries, the educational system itself is even less functional than it is in Western countries. Maybe with the exception of a country like Japan, which has some aspect in its educational system that I think are interesting. And of course, different countries. Now, aside from individual countries that have developed interesting aspects, and you mentioned this in your introduction, obviously, UNESCO is working on these issues, and they have access to leading researchers and thinkers in the field of education. And they have come up with very interesting, thought-provoking ideas about how education needs to be transformed, how we need to address various aspects of our humanity. The term of global citizenship education has been sort of established by UNESCO. But the sad fact is that very few schools and school people, whether in schools or universities, are aware of any of this. And so there's a lot of wisdom in, you know, in papers and books and statements that is not being put into practice.
Could you just give us some examples or some ideas on what this UNESCO is of transforming?
Well, yes, I think that in several of the statements of that have come from UNESCO during the past even couple of decades, they've been addressing, you know, for instance, that knowledge has different aspects, and you know, like for instance, there's a kind of knowledge of knowing how to be, which is just as important as knowing about a subject or knowing how to live together and things like that. But also, as I said, increasingly more I think there is this idea that we need to think in terms of a global society that doesn't exist yet. So we need to transform our world into a functional global society where we have unity and diversity, and that young people need to be educated to become such transformative agents and global citizens. But as I said, I mean, for that to happen, so in order that the world could transform, schools need to transform, and obviously the way that teachers think and work in schools needs to be transformed, so that schools could then become arenas for the transformation and for the realization of the true potential of the young people who attend them.
Stephen, what is your thoughts on this?
Well, of course, I'm not speaking from any particular professional expertise in the field of education, but just as a product of the system, so to speak. But when I sort of look at the current scene and where it maybe ought to go, I usually try to go back to first principles. And so my attempt at going back to first principles would start with the sort of question, well, what is the essence of humanity that we would need education? And obviously, in some way, we are not born complete. We need to be completed. There's some sense in which humanity exists in a state of potentiality, and that potentiality needs to be made, turned into actuality. So we can think of human essence, say, as a mine that has to be, that contains gems, and these gems have to be worked, you know, through dug out and brought out, and then faceted to really bring out the potentiality. Or maybe humanity is like a seed and it has to be tended to ultimately produce its fruit. And both of these metaphors suggest that there's some essential influence that has to come from the outside. And so that's maybe why, I don't know, philosophically or fundamentally, we would say that we need some form of education. But the big question then is, how do you develop this potentiality? And I can think of like three different, you know, paradigms overall that we could try to develop it. One we might ascribe to Carlos Castaneda, although many other people would do, but as a kind of a stand-in, as presenting a model of education which is really profoundly a matter of a journey of self-discovery and transformation, maybe even initiatic or mystical, where the ultimate goal is not necessarily even the acquisition of factual knowledge, but the expansion of consciousness and perception. So education focused on the individual and the individual's expanding awareness. A second way of thinking about education or paradigm would be one which is maybe a tool for personal knowledge, acquisition of virtue, but which is more focused on our individuality in relationship to society. So education in the service, say, of social engineering. And here we might invoke Plato as an early advocate of education with a very social focus. Although with Plato, his prescription for education was perhaps excessively prescriptive and rigid in relation to our modern standards. And his view of education didn't leave that much room for personal freedom or the exploration of subjects beyond, you know, a state-sanctioned curriculum. And even Plato would go to the extreme of saying we may even need some sort of noble lie that we tell people that people are born into certain categories, you know, bronze, silver, and gold, in order to maintain this, you know, the stability of society. So that would be like a second way of thinking about it. And a third way of thinking about education is not in relation to the individual primarily or in relation to the society, but in relation to what we regard as divine, in relation to God. Here we could invoke St. Ignatius of Loyola and the Jesuit model of education, which is a model of education which emphasizes, you know, pursuit of excellence and service to others, but with the focus of serving God, with this idea that education has to do with coming into right relationship with God. And this educational model is deeply committed to the service of others, especially those who are marginalized or less fortunate. And so maybe in a grossly oversimplified way, we can imagine sort of paradigms of education as oriented either towards the individual or towards society or towards the divine. But in a modern secular context, we can't really talk about education in relation to the divine anymore. That's been taken out. You know, let's say the post-Enlightenment, you know, one of the consequences of the Enlightenment is that we no longer talk about religious or spiritual education, except as a sort of side case. But when we talk about education for the world and how are we going to roll out a kind of universal global curriculum, if such a thing could be done, we're no longer thinking, well, we need to include some sort of theological component or some sort of explicit idea of education in relation to God. But I think doing that creates a kind of missing piece. You know, I'm not suggesting that we have to go back to religious education as it was done before. You know, we can't go back to the way things were done before. But this loss of the sacred has, you know, left a collective hole in our psyches in a way. But it's also left kind of a collective hole in how we might think about the educational process. It sort of takes out maybe one of the pieces, one of the ways in which we thought about education. And of course, that's particularly urgent today, is to find some new kind of narrative that awakens us to the reality of the limitation, the resource limitations of this planet, the reality of the interconnectedness of all cultures and peoples, the reality of the oneness of the human species. All of this needs to be cultivated through education. And our current educational systems are not doing that well enough because they're too focused, as Cameron said, they're too focused on churning out people who can be productive in a sort of economic context. But to get to this idea of global citizenship, to get to this idea of addressing these existential challenges of the day, somehow I think we need to bring back in the idea of orientation towards something greater than all of us. What in the past we've called God, what in the past we've defined through various theological systems, but is there some way to bring back a kind of sacred narrative of humanity that is that is alive to the realities of today, alive to the realities of what we've learned over the last five centuries of scientific, you know, progress and enlightenment and the birth of reason, that doesn't go back to the superstitions of past ages, but somehow awakens us to a higher kind of goal that can be an effective force to unite us, an effective force to bring us into this awareness of something like global citizenship.
And of course, one of the reason, there are several reasons why we have left out this spiritual understanding of human being in education. One is, of course, that we have this idea that teachers are not supposed to preach. But the funny thing is that there will always be preaching in school. I mean, that could be the preach that we should be democratic, or the preach that we are supposed to get knowledge, to get a normal life, and so on and so on. So there will always be preachers. So that's, and the other problem is of course that we live in societies where different religious position or thoughts exist, and there are some problems that could be. Some problems between different religious opinions, but then we have started to say that maybe one of the solution could be that we could discuss this idea about divinity in school and give all the young students a room where they are actually being able to try to express their feelings or their understanding of their spirituality. But then also, I started to think that maybe we're becoming too intellectual, and that maybe we should think more practical on this whole idea about this spiritual existence. What about existential rituals? Is this one of the problems with our society today, that we are we the rituals we are having in our society are very, they are non-existential. They're just on the surface. So just wondering if is there something wrong with our normal practice in life?
Very interesting thought that you put forward, and it sort of makes me think that there is definitely, as many great thinkers of the past have also voiced it, there's a close relationship between our notions of a higher force and our understanding of our own true selves. And I think that one of the biggest crises of our times is what one could call a crisis of identity, that people in general, young people in particular, do not really understand who they are or what they have the potentiality of being. What, you know, because it's very interesting that at school we learn everything about atoms up to galaxies. We learn very little about ourselves as human beings. I mean, I'm not referring now to our biological being, but what is really a human being? Who am I? Yeah, this is an essential question that every human being needs to be able to answer. And I think it should be in many ways the core of the curriculum. Now, I just want to share also a sort of an anecdote which goes together with what Steve was just saying. Back in the early 90s, I happened to be in a situation where I represented the university, and together with the largest teacher education university in Russia, I mean, this was just when the Soviet Union had turned into Russia, we organized a big international conference with the theme of teachers as global change agents. And because this was a very prestigious university, the then Minister of Education of Russia was a guest of honor there. And as I was one of the organizers of the conference, I was seated at the same table with him. He spoke only Russian and I didn't speak Russian, so there was somebody translating. So I asked him, it was interesting for me, I said, Mr. Minister, at this point in the development of your country, what do you think is the most important need within your educational system? And without even thinking 10 seconds, he immediately answered that we are in need of something that corresponds to what you in Western countries call religious education. Now, I think what he was referring to was more like some sort of a existential and moral foundation for life, because obviously as when communism fell, it was like the ideological carpet was pulled from underneath the feet of millions of people who had built sort of their worldview on that. And it somehow sort of, made it evident that we need something firmer to stand on. So I just, when I was listening to Steve, this particular conversation with the then Minister of Education of Russia came to my mind.
This is such a hard nut to crack. You know, we feel like we're almost saying what we need to bring back is a component of ritual, you know, a component of something that goes beyond the intellectual, something that's experiential, that's a part of our of the educational process, something, and that experiential component has to somehow bring us face to face with others in a kind of deeper relationship. But in the past, these sorts of rituals were always connected to a particular dogma or a particular theological mm-hmm. framework. And if we can't go back to that, if we can't go back to say, well, let's just pick some dogma and make that the foundation of you, obviously we can't go that direction. But can we separate out the experiential component, that sort of sense of the sacred, the thing that we want people to have a kind of universal experience of? How do we separate that out from the baggage? How do we separate the baby from the bathwater, I guess, is the question. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what the answer is.
Yeah. But you see, I think this is also to do with the fact that when we, for instance, teach religions at school, we always tend to highlight the differences between them and try to sort of show how they're different in their views and perceptions and so. But essentially, actually, there's a lot of universal and general. I mean, there's lots of truths or lots of beliefs that all world religions, for instance, share. So actually, if we were to go for that sort of core of religious or spiritual or mystical thinking, whatever you want to call it, I think we would find a lot of sort of aspects that would be acceptable to anyone from, you know, coming from any particular tradition, and would maybe open up the way to something which is more universal. I don't know how you think about that.
If you try to make one example, maybe to pray.
Mm.
Could be. I'm not sure if that's something that is common in all religious.
I think it is. Yeah.
I'm just wondering because to pray often has something to say to do with that you're trying to talk with the divine, but it doesn't have to. Even religious position that doesn't have any divine, like. Personalized God would still have the possibility of praying.
Prayer is such a great example because there's a sense in which we think of prayer maybe commonly in the West as a form of conversation with God. You know, you're talking to God, you're asking things from God, maybe God will grant them or not. But the phenomenon of prayer is much broader than that. I mean, in a way, one could say everything exists in a state of prayer. You know, the plant is praying, you know, when it stretches its leaves towards the sun to receive the light of the sun. So at the sort of other extreme, one can think of prayer in a much more abstract sense as an orientation towards that which is the source of grace. And of course, every culture has some form of prayer. And this orientation towards the source of grace, even more broadly, is perhaps expressed in the arts and in music. And maybe this is one non-intellectualizing way of thinking about how an educational program might help to invoke in people this sense of interconnectedness, this sense of the coherence of the human project across time and culture.
Mm-hmm.
Not just by, you know, reading the philosophical texts and the histories and all of the bad things that have happened and all of the great ideas and everything, which is also important, but to have some experience of the art, to have some experience of the phenomenon of prayer in that culture, to have some momentary glimpse of what it's like to be on the inside of those cultures, to the extent that we can do that. And maybe one can do that as well or better by participating in art or culture as reading a text pertaining to that culture.
Let me share another anecdote here. Many years ago, I was working with a youth leadership program in a school in Sweden, and I wanted to get to the essence of what these young people were really sort of wanting to learn and what was important for them. So I said, you know, let's imagine that I'm this genie from the bottle or the lamp, and I'm not going to fulfill three of your wishes, but I will answer three of your questions. So you can ask me three questions, and these are going to be the last three questions you can ever ask in your life. So what would these questions be? This was a setup. I was trying to sort of get to what was really important for them. And the interesting thing was that there were three categories of questions that emerged. And the largest one of them were existential questions. So young people think about these things. They are concerned about these things, you know, like, why am I here? What's the purpose of life? What's going to happen when I die? And so forth. Is there life on other planets? Whatever, things like that. The problem is that there is really no time, or there's no context in the educational system where these issues would be discussed. And even in those countries where there's something called religious education, it is not really usually used for this kind of discussions. And it's more like looking at different religions from a sort of a socio-historical perspective. Now, I think that it would be ideal if we could actually tie, and I think it can be done, that the various subjects and the various forms of knowledge that we are putting forward to young people in school would all be somehow tied to these fundamental questions of humanity. So what does, for instance, I mean, so let's take a subject such as mathematics, because usually, you know, everybody thinks mathematics is difficult and boring, and why should we learn these things? And we try to justify it by saying, well, you know, if you know mathematics, you'll be able to, I don't know, calculate the interest rate on your loan or something like that, something very pragmatic. But how about if you can learn mathematics so that it can help you to better understand, I don't know, multidimensionality of life, or you know, through fractals, the beauty of everything in existence, and so forth. So I think that we could exactly.
And what did you say, Stephen?
Yeah, or music. I mean, go back to the origins of mathematics. You know, Pythagoras. Mathematics was intertwined with music. It was a sacred
art. Exactly. Or if you learn history, if you learn about, you know, like if you learn about the human body, all of these things can be used as sort of ways and doors to better understanding or awakening new questions about our I think, human, what it is to be a human being, about different existential questions and so forth. I think this is a linkage that is seldom used at schools, but I think we should, and it could make a huge difference.
You mentioned these three paradigms, Stephen. And when I have been listening to Cameron, I have this feeling that this the first paradigm and the third paradigm is actually close connected. But then I wonder if does there exist like a fourth paradigm that's actually the way we are having our educational system today? I mean, this idea about the cog and society is, because I wouldn't say that Plato's paradigm, a way of thinking education, would fit with our modern way of understanding the educational system. But still, maybe we have the same direction towards the society, and but of course the there's something really missing, and or that the direction of this idea that the society is about economics, maybe that's one of the problem, because in the Greek sense, oikos, or economic, means private, and the opposite of economic would be polis, or society. So we have turned like it upside down, that we have turned economic into the society, and then we have more or less destroyed polis as society. And what we have destroyed in a sense, and it's maybe it's not possible with this global citizenship, because in the Greek sense, everybody that was part of polis, or a political part of reality, they had some kind of connection, physical connection. And also this conversation that there has to be like a political or a public conversation that also brings up a question about divinity. And that's something I'm really missing in the modern society. This public discussion about the spirituality, that the spiritual part have become private, but the economic part has become social.
Very good point. Yes. So, yes, if you could turn schools into arenas where existential or spiritual questions could be openly discussed, and that young people could ask the questions that are in their minds, yes, I think that would make a huge difference. And of course, for them to be helped to also look into these things from new perspectives. But of course, that would then require teachers who in their, you know, that this is the whole thing, you know, we need teachers who also have that kind of a worldview, that actually do see these issues as real and as being important, and so that they can take them up with the students.
Yeah, but it's also it's not only about this discussion or this to discuss this existential question, but it's also like when you were this example of mathematics, that would also be part of the divine knowledge.
Yeah, absolutely.
That to be universal, and also that could also be some rituals that actually could help human to become more, how to say it, more in balance with oneself and with existence. I think that's one of the, I find it very hard when I discuss the mathematics position in school. I often wonder why do we present it in the way we do, and why don't we try to get those feelings around mathematics action? And it's actually earlier, before this podcast, I was listening to a podcast about how even animals have this numeric notion born into their and like children, they have it before they get born. They must have it to be able to grasp reality as they do. And so why is mathematics so difficult, and why doesn't we try being able to feel that this is actually something that is part of myself?
I wish I knew why, because it's there's this artificial distinction that people draw between mathematics, learning, becoming numerate, you know, learning how to calculate a compute and so forth, and that's seen as, you know, the opposite end of the arts and music and feeling things deeply and so forth. And that seems like such a modern artificial division that's somehow been driven, this wedge that's been driven between these two sort of polarities of human experience that wasn't there originally. I mean, Pythagoras was such a mystic someone infused with a sense of the sacred and the sense of numbers being the manifestation of the sacred, and particularly numbers as expressed through ratio, and ratio being expressed through music and geometry and so forth. I think a lot of mathematicians would certainly understand those who end up delving into it, you know, professionally and deeply, are awestruck by the beauty of mathematics. It can make you weep, you know, learning about Euler's equation and how it brings together incredibly disparate elements of the mathematical universe into one amazingly simple package. How could the universe be so constructed that it simplifies so much in such a beautiful way? That's an incredibly aesthetic thing. It's art and music all together on the page in a few simple characters. How could we convey this to our children and to the next generation? How is it that we've gone so far off base that we have allowed mathematics and science to become these activities which are totally devoid of spirit, and to relegate the spiritual things over to some far end of the humanities? What has led to this artificial polarization in our way of thinking? We can point our finger to the approximation that let's say ignited the scientific revolution, that, well, let's, for the sake of simplicity, not talk about the qualitative nature of the universe. Let's just talk about the quantitative nature of the universe, because that's what we can measure and that's what we can all objectively agree on, and let's run with that. And it produces this incredible result of this penetration of the laws of nature and uncovering these hidden patterns. Incredibly useful, but somewhere along the way, we've forgotten that this initial step that was taken. There's a great book about this, with Galileo's error. That it wasn't really an error. It was a, it was a conscious, simplification of the human experience. Let's not consider the qualitative aspect. But somewhere along the way, we've forgotten that that was just a simplification. And now what has resulted from this procedure of just thinking about the world entirely in terms of quantity, entirely in terms of mathematical law, is that now we have whole generations of people raised thinking that, well, that's the reality, and this qualitative component is the unreality. To the extent that we have learned people writing about how things like consciousness are actually illusions, that they don't actually exist, because we fooled ourselves into thinking that this is real, when it's really just an epiphenomenal result of the banging together of atoms in the end, and the interaction of mathematical waves. Whereas our original experience is that of consciousness. But we've convinced ourselves somehow that the thing that is most real is actually the thing that is most unreal. So it's an unfortunate side effect of the baby and of the bathwater, of having tossed out the bathwater. A big part of the baby has gone out with it. But bringing it in is br bringing it back in is the problem that no one seems to have the solution to, because how do you bring the baby back in without bringing in the bathwater along with the baby? Without bringing back in theological ideas and frameworks that are no longer useful for today, that no longer are meet the needs of humanity, because in various ways they were essentially tribalistic and essentially divided one group of people from another, created in groups and out groups. That seems to be the baggage that's gone along with this, perception of the divine, which is such an intrinsic part of the human experience, and which ought not to be divorced from our mathematical and scientific explorations of things.
So could one maybe draw the conclusion that what we really need in education is a new discourse, a discourse that actually addresses these questions? As you said, yes, we don't have the ready answers because this is something new. This is something we need to now discover. We need to discover and create, and yes, I think it's interesting that as we have developed in our science and technology, we have more and more taken upon us the sort of attitude of mastering the world around us, and lost the ability of feeling the awe and the wonder and the majesty of what we're sort of surrounded by. So, and maybe one, I mean, you talked about Pythagoras. There is a more recent figure very well known in educational circles. He was an Enlightenment thinker, Comenius, you know, the great Czech thinker. He was an interesting person because he was a very devout Christian, but he was also very scientific. And he, I think he had a sort of an idea that the kind of kingdom of God on earth is something that human beings have to construct. It's not something that's going to happen miraculously coming from, you know, sort of Deus ex machina. So he saw the role of education as being, he used, because he was an Enlightenment philosopher, he used this very interesting analogy. He said that schools should become factories of light. Mm-hmm. And I think that what he was after was that schools would become places where people would find this enlightenment in the deepest sense, and then from that enlightenment go out and make this world an enlightened world, a world of light, a world of beauty, and bring the sort of the divine beauty and perfection into this world. And I think that this is really what we need today. I think anything less than that is neither going to satisfy us in our innermost selves, and is not going to solve the huge social issues that are now tearing at the fabric of humanity.
The light back into enlightenment.
Yes, exactly.
I think one last comment is that I think this idea about the tribal way of thinking, I think that there's still a lot of it. And I find a lot of people trying to say that we have like cultural knowledge or tribal knowledge, that there's just only, they are more into what you said, Cameron, that we are focusing on the differences instead mm-hmm. of the similarities, and what is actually bringing human together and also having more like a universal approach to reality. And I think like mathematics should be a very a simple way of having those universal feelings. Mm. But also what is similar between religious position, for instance. So maybe that could also be a way to go.
Absolutely.
So I think we should end for this session. I think we have, I'm not so sure if we have solved anything actually, but maybe we have come a little step further to combine Athens and Jerusalem. I think it was a very nice conversation, and thank you both for being together with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Athens and Jerusalem, created by Cameron Namdar, Stephen Phelps, and Knut Ove Essay. Nora Juhl is the broadcast voice and technical support. Music is pieces of Edvard Grieg's Morning Mood. The voices in the intro are Viktor Frankl, interview with Robert Oppenheimer, and Pope John Paul II. Thank you for listening, and please check out another episode.